So, okay, we all know about a quarter of the universe is made out of dark matter, but we have no idea what it is. Everything we know from dark matter comes from its gravitational influence in the universe, which tells us nothing about the particle physics properties of dark matter. So if we want to understand the particle theory of dark matter, we have to go beyond that to figure out what are the non-gravitational interactions of dark matter. Now, there are many ways that people have proposed to look for dark matter's non-gravitational interactions. You have direct detection, where you're looking for dark matter in the local wind of the Milky Way halo scattering off of standard model particles in your detector. You have colliders, where you can collide standard model particles to produce dark matter in your accelerator. And you have indirect detection, where you have dark matter particles in halos annihilating to produce standard model particles that you see in telescopes. So, there's good reasons, and there's very well-motivated theories that dark matter should show up, hopefully, in one or more of these different avenues. But all of these different avenues are really motivated by the WIMP paradigm, where dark matter should couple to the standard model through some new physics at the weak scale. Well, we haven't discovered any new physics at the weak scale. What if dark matter has a very suppressed coupling to the standard model? Is there any hope for learning anything about the dark sector? Yes, there is. There's another process you can think about for exploring the physics of dark matter, which is called dark matter self-interactions. So you can have dark matter particles just scattering elastically with other dark matter particles in a dark matter halo, and this can leave an imprint on the shapes of galaxies, which you can see. So here's the outline. So the motivation for thinking about self-interactions comes from some long-standing issues with the cold dark matter paradigm. Now, the C in CDM usually stands for cold, but it also stands for collisionless. It's kind of implicit. So the usual paradigm, which is what a WIMP is that dark matter should be both cold and collisionless, so it doesn't really have self-interactions very much. Now, there are some issues, and these issues are discrepancies between theory in the form of n-body simulations predicting what dark matter should look like in galaxies, what should the shape of galaxies be, and astrophysical observations measuring the shapes of galaxies. So these discrepancies can be solved, perhaps, by dark matter that has self-interactions. And so what I'm going to discuss are, what are the particle physics implications of dark matter that's self-interacting? And then you can think about these dark matter halos and self-interactions in the halo as kind of a particle collider, in a sense, where your halo is an energetic reservoir of dark matter particles that are colliding. Actually, I'm not going to discuss this, but I left that in from a previous talk. But it's also complementary with the other searches for WIMPs. Okay, so there are some indications that the CDM paradigm is in trouble. So I'm going to talk in some detail about this. And so there are three main issues that people talk about. First is the core versus cusp problem. The core versus cusp problem comes from looking at the central densities of dark matter halos. So the way you think about it is you parameterize the density rho, mass density, as some power of radius, where the power, or if you like the logarithmic slope alpha, characterizes the central density. So the prediction from n-body simulation is that alpha should be around -1 as r goes to 0. This is called the NFW profile, otherwise known as a cusp, because the density increases steeply. But what people find is that dark matter density has this logarithmic slope alpha to be close to 0, which is called a core. So the density is flat as r goes to 0. So that's one issue. The second issue is called the too-big-to-fail problem. In a nutshell, the too-big-to-fail problem is as follows. N-body simulations predict that there should be a population of around 10 satellites in the Milky Way, which are even more massive than the ones we've observed. So the question is, where are they? Now, one way you can get around this is just by saying that, well, maybe these very massive dark matter halos are out there around our Milky Way, but maybe they're just dark. Maybe they just haven't had a lot of stars formed inside of them. Perhaps just normal astrophysical processes have stripped out the star-forming material from these dark matter halos. But the thinking is that these massive satellite halos correspond to deep potential wells, And it's difficult for astrophysics to strip out star-forming material from these guys. So the name comes from these halos should be too big to fail in forming stars. So we should be able to see them, but we can't.
Well, I think maybe you said, I think the point is that you have seen smaller things, so those should not fail.
Yes.
You've seen smaller things lighting up the star, so there is no reason to expect the bigger
yes.
thing to fail.
That's right. That's yeah. good, another good point.
Because, originally, the issue was that the prediction was hundreds of really small things. But
yeah, I'll get to that one as number three. Yes.
I mean, you can kind of think of Quarkusp and too big to fail as two sides of the same coin, just on different scales. And Quarkusp is on the density, too big to fail is like a flatter velocity profile.
It's not necessarily the same thing. It's absolutely not necessarily the same thing. The quark versus Scott's problem could be resolved completely with Gasper physics. Just things getting ejected from the. I mean, you're really dominated by baryons.
No, I'll discuss that.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay. Then it goes for radials, you're not dominated by baryons.
Yeah.
Mass to light ratio is like 100.
The third problem is called the missing satellite problem. It's similar, in a sense, to the too big to fail problem, but not talking about the largest halos that should be there, but talking about the smallest halos. And so this is just a numbers issue. There are predicted from n-body simulations, just a population of a huge number of satellites that should be there around the Milky Way that we just don't find. Now, unlike the too big to fail satellites, these objects are small potential wells, and so it should be easier for just normal astrophysics to strip out the star-forming material. And so in a sense, these objects are, in a sense, small enough to fail. And so this problem, perhaps, is not really a problem with CDM, but just can be solved by astrophysics. OK, so I'm going to talk about these problems in a little more detail. So first, core versus cusp. Cores seem fairly ubiquitous wherever we look. So we can look at field dwarfs, so just your random dwarf out there in the universe. There are also the satellite dwarf spheroidals around the Milky Way. There are also objects called low surface brightness galaxies, which are very dark matter dominated spiral galaxies. And there's also clusters. And cores have been found in all of these things. So I'll go through that. So first, cores and field dwarfs. So this is where the core versus cusp problem first cropped up a long time ago. This is kind of showing you a latest iteration of that. So this comes from a survey called THINGS, which stands for the H1 Near Galaxy Survey. So these are seven dwarfs that have been mapped out in their hydrogen gas through 21 centimeter emission. So here they are. You can see them as a picture. Now, by measuring the kinematics of the gas, you can plot the dark matter density profile. And so here is the density as a function of radius. And all of those seven dwarfs are just overlaid on top of each other. And so what you see is that it seems like the dwarfs favor a density profile that flattens out into a core instead of a sharp cusp, which would be predicted by an n-body simulation. So there's also been studies of cores found in dwarf spheroidals in the Milky Way. So this is from a paper by Walker and Peña Rubia a few years ago. And they were looking at two dwarves in particular, Sculptor and Fornax. And so here's the basic argument. So in each one of these dwarves, these authors identified two separate stellar subpopulations in the dwarf. One is metal poor and one is metal rich. And the way to think about it is you can think of each population as like a test mass in your gravitational potential. And so by measuring the rotation of a test mass at two different radii, you can plot the slope of the enclosed mass. Okay, so here is enclosed mass as a function of radius, just by measuring the velocity of each of these two test masses. And so here are sort of the points for each one of these test masses. So if you just plot the slope, you can get a handle on what the density is. So okay, enclosed mass is just d3r rho. And if rho goes like 1 over r, then the slope should be 2 in enclosed mass. And if rho is a constant, the slope should be 3. And so what they find is that, OK, a slope of 3 seems to fit better than a slope of 2. It seems to favor a core and a cusp. There have also been cores found in these LSBs, low surface brightness spiral galaxies. So probably it's hard to see, but there's been a survey of a large number of these objects. And in their inner, at the inner radius, you can characterize it again by this logarithmic slope alpha. and alpha seems to be larger than minus 1, indicating that the profile is flatter than you'd expect from in-body simulation. Then a new recent development has been that cores have been found also in clusters. So here is a very nice picture of a cluster, A2667. So the center of the cluster is here. There's a massive elliptical galaxy inside the cluster. Okay. So, and then you can also see like some gravitational lensing effects. So what has been done in this paper by Newman et al. Has been to combine different astrophysical probes spanning a wide range of radii. So at very small radius, you're thinking about the motions of stars inside of the elliptical galaxy in the center of the cluster as probing the dark matter halo mass distribution in the center of the cluster halo. Then at larger radius, you're using strong lensing, again, to probe the dark matter mass distribution. And then at even larger radius, you're using weak lensing to probe the dark matter mass distribution.
Galaxy, and it mostly subjected to dark matter produced within this galaxy or the overall kind of, I guess I'm asking, there is a profile of distribution of dark matter within the cluster, but then there is a galaxy on top, so it should have additional boost to dark matter?
No, I mean, I guess the picture is that the dark matter halo in the dark matter halo of the central galaxy is just indistinguishable from the halo of the larger cluster. So you think about this cluster as just living inside.
Is there a boost for the dark matter sort of number counts due to the central galaxy?
Just due to the dark matter of the central galaxy versus the dark matter of the halo. So those two things are not distinguishable.
That means that the dark matter of the galaxy is a small addition to the
No, there's just no way of separating out those two components. So you should not really think of it as two separate objects, one living on top of one another.
What do you expect? I mean, I have no idea. You see what I'm asking? That there is a contribution to the dark matter.
So the,
I mean, there is a smooth profile in the cluster, right, more or less. And then there is a addition.
No. The idea is that the brightest central galaxy, which is this elliptical, just lives inside of that, what you would call the cluster halo. Yeah.
No, doesn't have its own halo.
No. Or if you like, the whole cluster halo is its own halo, in a sense. So there's no distinction. Okay. So using these different probes, you can map out the dark matter distribution across a large range of radius. So here is what is found for this particular cluster. So here is log of the density as a function of radius. The blue is the dark matter density that you would infer. The red is the distribution of stars. And then the total mass is shown in green. Okay. So the dark matter distribution. And the point is that it flattens out to form a core compared to what you would expect from n-body simulations. N-body simulations predicted the slope should be around minus 1, which is what this solid line is showing.
What is Cn of W versus
Gn of W? So they're fitting to two particular forms of modified NFW profiles that allow for a shallower slope. So GnFW is rho s, I think it's like rs to some power beta, and then 1 plus r over rs, something like 3 minus beta. So I think it's something like this. So you're allowed for a shallower slope at small radius, you can have a shallower slope compared to 1 over r. It's 1 over r to the beta. And then the CNFW is similar. You just have like something like R over RC. So you have some additional core radius. And then I think there's some normalization like RS over RC, something like that. So this one allows for a core where the slope is really zero, and this one allows for a shallower slope, which is beta.
And then just quickly, not things that are seen in simulation.
Yeah, totally phenomenological. Yeah. The data is not shown. So the only thing is shown with respect to the data is the range at which these different probes are constraining the profiles at different radii.
Okay,
so there's also the too big to fail problem. So the Milky Way galaxy should have this population of extra satellites, which we don't see. So the way you think about it is, okay, so I've done a simulation. Here, this is dark matter only. So the white that you're seeing is the dark matter distribution. Now, this is like a Milky Way-sized dark matter halo, and the Milky Way obviously lives in the center of that. Then you have all these satellite galaxies. And so the naive thing to do would be just to say that, okay, let's pick out the 9 biggest satellites from the simulation and just match those to the 9 biggest satellites in the real Milky Way. So how do we match them? Well, you want to compare the rotation curves that you predict from the simulation versus the rotation curves that we observe. So that's shown in this plot here. So this is the rotation curve, circular velocity, as a function of radius. And each one of these lines, both the solid and the dashed, is a prediction for a rotation curve in an individual satellite from the simulation. So let's say the 9 most massive satellites would give a rotation curve, which is shown by these solid red lines. And then for the next smallest satellites, those would be rotation curves, which are shown by these dotted lines here. Okay, so the black points show you the data. Now, unfortunately, you're looking at a projection on the sky when you're trying to measure the rotation curves of these satellites. And so you don't have complete information to extract the entire rotation curve for, let's say, Sculptor. The best you can do is pick out one point along that rotation curve, and that's shown by these dots here. So each dot is one point along a rotation curve for one observed satellite. Now, when one of the simulated satellites passes through one of these data points, then you can match the predicted satellite from the simulation to the observed satellite in the real Milky Way. And what you find is that, okay, there's a population of order 10, satellites from the simulation, which can't be matched to any of the observed satellites. Where are they?
So,
problems with CDM. Is this a problem with CDM? Well, it might just be a problem of our interpretation of the data. So all of the expectations from CDM that I mentioned come from simulations which are only including dark matter. So the real universe, of course, is not just dark matter, but it's dark matter plus baryons. And so maybe we just can't use dark matter-only simulations to infer things about the real world, the real universe. Maybe baryonic physics affects the central density of these dark matter halos. Maybe it's just the astrophysical observations are not being modeled correctly. Maybe there are additional degrees of freedom which need to be taken into account, such as the anisotropy and things like this. Okay, this can also explain some of the observations. So there are definitely plausible vanilla explanations for explaining away these problems. On the other hand, the really exciting possibility is that maybe dark matter is not CDM.
One of the things he emphasized that there is a lot of sort of heterogeneity in this rotation curve data and so on. So you know, kind of as physicists who tend to think that everything will come calibrated, you know, and there is like similar size small halos that have steeper than wanted profile of velocities in the center. Some shallower, so there is probably a lot of room for reading some extra physics with bearings and so on.
Yeah, I agree. There's a big caveat. So here I'm going to talk about explaining cusp versus core with baryonic physics, in particular supernova feedback. So this is trying to explain the observations from things in field dwarfs just using astrophysics. And so the basic idea is that if you have a lot of gas in these objects, which the things dwarfs do have, you have a lot of supernovae. And so if you have a lot of supernovae, you can blow out a lot of gas, and it's a non-adiabatic process, and you'll disrupt the central dark matter distribution to take a cusp into a core. So what these authors find, including supernova physics in their simulation, is that so here is plotted the logarithmic slope alpha evaluated at a certain radius as a function of basically how much baryons you have in the halo. So what they find is that if you have enough baryons, you have enough baryonic feedback, you have enough supernovae to shallow out the central density compared to the expectation from NFW, where if you have less baryonic matter, then you don't have that effect. Okay. So it's plausible that this works. It requires sort of a bursty star formation history where you have not just one era of supernovae, but you have like repeated bursts where you have a burst and then that material collapses back down and it keeps bursting again. It also depends on how well you trust your implementation of supernova physics in the simulation. In particle physics language, you're including physics which is below the scale of your effective theory, or above the scale of your effective theory. So, okay, it depends on how you do that. So that might be one explanation for explaining cores in field dwarfs. And there's other mechanisms you can think about for explaining cores in other objects. For example, for Milky Way satellites, you don't have enough baryons to form cores through supernovae. But you also have an additional effect due to the interaction of those satellites with the baryonic disk of the Milky Way. And so people think maybe that effect can solve the core versus cusp in the Milky Way satellites. Low surface brightness galaxies. Well, actually, people don't know how to solve this using baryonic physics. They're very metal poor. So you think that, OK, there hasn't been a lot of supernovae. They're just isolated, so there's not some kind of environmental effect. We don't really know at this point. Clusters also have cores. There's another effect, which is feedback from AGN. So you can also have a massive outflowing of baryonic material due to AGN. That can affect the distribution of dark matter and turn a cusp into a core. So there's lots of plausible explanations for forming cores in these objects. But I guess you can see that, well, in each one, you kind of need a different explanation. You can also try to explain away the too big to fail problem. So this number of order 10 is subject to some statistical variation. Okay. So if you want to tune it away just as a fluke, you need some like 10% tuning. Another way to get rid of the too big to fail problem is you say the mass of the Milky Way is smaller. If the mass of the Milky Way halo is smaller, you'd expect less massive satellites. So if you make the mass of the Milky Way smaller by a factor of 2 or so, you can get rid of the too big to fail problem. Okay, you can also have baryonic effects. Again, if you form cores in these dwarf spheroidals due to baryons, then you can modify the rotation curves and explain the too big to fail problem that way. Okay, but there's also a too big to fail problem people have found, not just in the Milky Way, but also in Andromeda, and also in the local group. So if you want to explain the too big to fail problem due to baryons and an environmental effect in the Milky Way and Andromeda, because they're close to large disk, a large baryonic disk, then maybe you can't use that explanation for explaining too big to fail problem in satellites which are not associated with a massive host. Okay. So the other more extreme possibility is that, well, maybe you solve these problems if dark matter is self-interacting. So what are self-interactions? So the basic idea is that you can have two dark matter particles which just interact through elastic scattering. So what happens? So what happens when you have self-interactions is that the center part of the dark matter halo is very cold, and the part outside is a lot hotter. And so when a particle that's hotter comes through the cold center, it collides, transfers energy, and it heats up the colder particles in the center. And so those particles which were forming your cusp get kind of puffed out due to heating and form, turn into a quark. So the particles that were here in the NFW, the particles that were predicted to be here in a halo with a cusp get kicked out due to self-interactions to a larger radius. And so this is how you flatten a cusp and turn it into a quark. Now, this also solves the too big to fail problem, of course, because if you're changing the density profiles, you're changing the enclosed mass here, and there you change the circular velocity. And so the circular velocities that you predicted to be up here when you had no self-interactions, just CDM, get lowered because you have less enclosed mass. And so now you can reconcile the satellites that you predict from a simulation with the satellites we observe. So here are some plots from N-body simulations where people include self-interactions in the simulation. Okay, so here is showing the cusp versus quark problem. So focus on the black lines to start with. Each of these black lines is a density profile for a different dwarf galaxy. Now, if I turn on self-interactions, let's say this blue line, these blue lines would be one self-interacting dark matter model, you change the density profiles where you had a steep profile to form a quark. Now here's the too big to fail problem. Here's circular velocity as a function of radius for CDM. You see you have a population of order 10 satellites, which don't match any of the observed satellites. But now when you turn on self-interactions, these density profiles come down, and now these lines are passing through these different points. Okay, so it's an extreme hypothesis. Maybe dark matter is self-interacting. What does this tell us about the underlying particle physics of the dark sector? So the thing that we're sensitive to is basically the number of scatterings, which is the cross-section times the number density, which is just the mass density divided by the mass, times the velocity times the h. And you want this number of scatterings to be larger than 1 over the age of the halo. It's a complicated issue which cross section is the right one to use.
I thought it would be transport cross section. Momentum transport cross section.
No, I think it's this other cross section called the viscosity cross section.
Okay, but it's
it should not be
at
the
long at the yes. large impact parameters, it should receive the same cutoff as the transport cross section and it would be different.
Well, yeah, not the elastic scattering.
Most of what people have been assuming are short-range interactions anyway.
Yes. No, I agree. There's a subtlety where you don't want... You can have models where the elastic cross-section is hugely enhanced due to forward scattering.
Forward scattering has formally like power divergence cross-section,
yes.
Right? The transport cross-section is only long divergence.
Yes, I agree.
Difference.
I agree. So... the figure of merit, so the rho we know, the velocity you know, and the age you roughly know. The particle physics parameters that you don't know is cross-section divided by mass, okay, appearing here. And what you need roughly is that this cross-section per unit mass has to be around 1 cm² per gram, which in particle physics units is around 2 barns per GeV. This is roughly what you need. So, here's just a brief history of self-interacting dark matter. First proposed, okay, by Spergel and Steinhardt, and the interaction they had in mind is that the sigma, the cross-section, is just a constant. Now, it was realized very quickly that if you have a large enough constant cross-section on small scales to explain the problems in dwarfs, you run into problems on cluster scales. And it would be, in fact, excluded. So it was proposed that there could be a velocity-dependent cross-section, where cross-sections should scale like 1 over v, There's no real particle motivation for this kind of behavior, so okay, fine. And then basically I think people lost interest because your only choices were to be excluded or something garbage. Now it's kind of seen a little bit of a renaissance in the last few years, basically due to two reasons. One has been there have been improved simulations of self-interacting dark matter, and there's been improvements on the theory front where people have made more compelling models for self-interacting dark matter. So there are constraints on how large self-interactions can be. And so one of the early bounds which came about and which really killed self-interacting dark matter was this bound by Meralde Escude from the early 2000s. And the basic idea was looking at ellipticity of a cluster as inferred by gravitational lensing arcs of this particular object, MS2137. So it has these two lensing arcs here. There's one kind of tangential, and there's one radial here. And from these lensing arcs, you can infer something about the ellipticity of this cluster. Now, the prediction from self-interacting dark matter is that if dark matter is interacting a lot, it should tend to isotropize the halo. Halos should appear more spherical. And so that gives you a limit on how strongly interacting dark matter can be. And the limit that was derived was this 0.02 centimeters squared per gram, which is a very strong limit compared to what you need, around 1 centimeter squared per gram. Okay. This was revisited recently in the context of some real actual n-body simulations. And it was found that this bound was overestimated by around a factor of 100. Yeah, on a computer. All right. The second important constraint comes from halo shapes, looking at massive elliptical galaxies, which have been mapped out in X-ray emission. So here's a picture. And again, the expectation from self-interacting dark matter is that halos should look spherical. Now, this bound was also revisited recently and found to be weaker than previously thought, because this object's actually very much baryon-dominated in the center. So what happens is that if the density is dominated by baryons, this dark matter actually tracks the baryons, not the other way around. And so if you have an elliptical baryon distribution, self-interactions will cause dark matter to also be elliptical. It's not that this dark matter will become spherical and the baryons will track that. Okay? So that's also weaker. And then the other one, which is famous, is the Bullet cluster. So that constrains cross-section per unit mass to be less than around 1. That's still there. So the current consensus is that the cross-section per unit mass around 0.5 to 1 can be OK, even if it's constant. All right, so that's the story with the constraints. Now, what do we know about the particle physics side? So self-interactions are not some exotic particle physics idea. It's the same idea as Rutherford scattering, where you have elastic scattering, let's say you have an alpha particle and a nucleus due to photon exchange. Self-interactions are also just elastic scattering, where you have dark matter particles elastically scattering by exchanging some other kind of particle. You could think of it as a dark photon, or it's some mediator particle called phi. WIMPs also have self-interactions. You can scatter two WIMPs by exchanging the Z or some other particle at the TeV scale. The cross-section scales in this way, as 1 over mz to the fourth. Just plug in numbers. The cross-section for self-interactions is basically a weak scale cross-section, around 10 to the minus 36 centimeters squared, around 1 picobarn. Also the mass, it's around 100 GeV if it's a WIMP. So cross-section per unit mass is around 10 to the minus 14 centimeters squared per gram. It's around 14 orders of magnitude too small if you want to explain these anomalies. So if self-interacting dark matter is right, then it's definitely not a WIMP. So what do you need to get a larger cross-section? Well, OK, I just need to change what was the mediator particle here. Instead of having mz, I have mphi. And if I want to make this larger, I just need to make mphi lighter. So the mass of the mediator has to be much lighter than the weak scale, around 1 to 10 MeV. So that's the first lesson. If you want self-interactions to explain these anomalies, you need some new light mediator particle below a GeV scale. What's the second lesson? Now, if you have this new light mediator, which mediates scattering, then by definition, it implies a velocity-dependent cross-section. So let's just look at two extreme examples. You can have a contact interaction, like Fermi theory, where the mass of the mediator is much larger than the typical momentum of dark matter. In this case, the cross-section goes like a constant, OK, like this. The other extreme example is if the mediator is very light, the cross-section scales like 1 over v to the fourth. This is like Rutherford scattering. OK, I've drawn it like this. But in general, you have a very complicated velocity dependence as you interpolate between these two regimes. How do you figure it out? Let's work on it. So let's say we want to compute the dark matter scattering cross-section. We basically have three parameters to play around with: mass of dark matter, mass of the mediator, coupling constant. And depending on what the parameters are, you can be in one of two regimes. One, you can think of as the perturbative regime or the Born regime, which is easy to compute. Just plug into your quantum field theory and turn the crank. The other case is more complicated. You're in the non-perturbative regime. In that case, you don't just need to take into account the leading order scattering diagram, but you need to resum. You need to sum up all of these additional diagrams where you have an infinite number of insertions of five particle exchange. It's exactly the same as doing the Sommerfeld enhancement for annihilation. Could be a suppression as well. So I don't mean that it has to be an enhancement, but they're qualitatively similar. And what you do is not use quantum field theory, but use non-relativistic quantum mechanics. You have to solve the Schrodinger equation for the two-body wave function. You compute the phase shifts using a partial wave analysis, plug your partial waves into the cross-section, and then you compute it. It's, something an undergrad could do, in principle. So for this kind of...
My experience is they think that this sound is a phase shift.
Phase shift, we'll see. So, you just need to know the potential to solve the Schrodinger equation. And if you're thinking about the dark photon, for example, then the potential is just a Yukawa potential. You have your coupling constant divided by R, like a Coulomb potential, but then you have like a screening term, e to the minus m phi r. Okay, so now, turn the crank. What are the kinds of cross sections that you'll get? So here's an example. What's plotted here is cross section, times mass squared. The thing you're interested in is cross section per unit mass, but okay, fine. Just think of this as cross section as a function of velocity for a particular value of the coupling, and then for different ratios of these parameters, alpha, m, chi, which is the dark matter mass divided by the mediator mass.
If it's a dark photon, you kind of expect half positive or one positive, right?
Yes, that's right. That's exactly right. And we worked through those cases too. I'm just showing you the wide range of behaviors you can have.
Well, if it's
a scalar,
if it goes, it's more complicated. It's a plasma, and it might have plasma effects as well.
Yeah, it's very light. Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is just a case of it's an attractive interaction. You could also think of it as a dark Higgs, let's say. That would just be purely attractive. And so for different values of the parameters, you get a different velocity dependence of cross-section as a function of velocity. And so you could have something like this, which would be like a called an S-wave resonance, where it's strongly enhanced at small velocity, or it could be suppressed at small velocity, or it could just be flat, and then it tapers off. Or you can have some complicated structure of peaks and wiggles corresponding to like different resonances at high L modes. Okay, so that's what I mean. It's complicated to solve it in general. Fine. But the key point is that you want to think of cross-section as a function of velocity. Of course, this is obvious, right? Cross-sections depend on energy. So cores in different systems are actually probing self-interactions at different velocities and at different energies. So in dwarf galaxies, you have very low energies, with V over C is around 10 to the minus 4. In spiral galaxies like these LSBs, V over C is around 10 to the minus 3. And in clusters, V over C is around 10 to the minus 2. So by studying all of these different things, you're exploring two orders of magnitude in velocity or four orders of magnitude in kinetic energy. And so you can think of this as like different kinds of particle accelerators. Each one is like a different experiment with a different beam energy. Dwarf galaxies would be like your low energy precision machine, and clusters would be like the LHC. So here's the goal. Let's say I wanted to consider observations of cores in all these different systems as due to self-interactions. Is there a consistent model of self-interacting dark matter that can explain all of these different things? Okay, so but there, of course, is a big caveat. I'm not including any baryonic physics. In principle, you can. And this, you could think of this as like a background that you'd want to subtract from your experiment. Okay, and the second caveat is this is still unpublished. It's still in preparation, so it's kind of preliminary. Here's the basic idea. What we want is...
The last one, you mean just as a generic caution. You don't mean that you actually have reason to doubt it.
No.
Okay.
Yeah. It's still unpublished, and the numbers might change slightly. Okay, so here's the basic idea. What we want to do is take a dark matter halo from observations. So you're fitting to some astrophysical data, you extract a dark matter halo, it has a core, and you want to fit it to what cross-section does it imply. Now, it would be nice if you could just say run an n-body simulation every time you wanted to fit this. Okay, we can't do that. We need some kind of quasi-analytic way to figure this out. And so here's the way we're going to model it. So we have some density profile. So density is a function of radius. Let's say this is what we have, like this. Now, what you expect is since scattering is enhanced in the center of the halo, because it's scattering, you'd expect there to be some transition. And the transition radius is called R1. Inside of that transition radius, you'd expect self-interactions to have occurred more than once. And outside that radius, self-interactions have happened less than once. So the profile should look like self-interacting dark matter here, but then just like normal CDM outside of R1. It's different than that. The profile is different than isothermal sphere. So OK, here's the idea. So we're defining this radius R1 as where you've had one scattering over the lifetime of the halo. So this is cross-section averaged over velocity divided by mass times the density evaluated at R1 times the age. Should be greater than 1 or less than 1, depending on which region you are. OK. So once we figure out what the density profile is, you just plug it into this rate equation, and then you can figure out what's the cross-section times velocity divided by mass, which is equal to 1 over the density times the h. So how do we model the dark matter profile? So in the self-interacting dark matter regime, so inside of R1, where scatterings have happened more than once, we're basically just modeling dark matter as an ideal gas. So we're assuming that it has the same temperature, that it's at a constant pressure. Sorry, not a constant pressure, but it's at a constant temperature, and that it's isotropized. So it has just it's spherical. And so the basic idea is that you can assume that dark matter behaves as an ideal gas. So pressure is like KB times N, which is rho over the mass, times the temperature. Okay, and you can write this as just a constant sigma naught squared times rho. Sigma naught is just KB times the temperature divided by the mass. So sigma naught is just the one-dimensional velocity dispersion of the dark matter particles. And it's a constant because I'm assuming that the temperature is a constant. Okay. Now we just need an equation relating pressure to density. And so we're assuming that the dark matter halo's in hydrostatic equilibrium. So it just tells us that del P is equal to minus rho del phi, where phi is the total gravitational potential, including all of the mass, dark matter, and baryons. So just plug this into here, and you'll get this equation, which you can also get starting from the Jeans equation. So that's a simple way we're going to model it. So the things we don't know are what is the central density and what is the velocity dispersion. And so we're just going to solve, as a function of those two unknown parameters, what does the density profile look like. Then in the outer region, we're assuming that it matches onto NFW. So how do we match it? Well, I'm just going to require that the density is continuous at R1 and the enclosed mass is continuous at R1. So I want to think of self-interactions as just rearranging the particles inside of that radius R1, but leaving everything else unchanged outside of R1. Okay? So we have two conditions to fit the two unknown parameters of the NFW profile, RS and rho S. That's the assumption.
I mean, usually if you crank up the cross section in pi, right, I mean, you have it, right? Because you have evaporation from the inner region to outer.
Well, assuming all of that evaporation already took place.
Okay.
But this is really some sort of static equilibrium.
Okay.
So R1 is also another unknown parameter. We don't know what that is. And then so we need to scan over R1 as well. And then so in terms of those three parameters, the central density, rho naught, the one-dimensional dispersion, sigma naught, and R1, three unknown parameters which characterize, you know, the whole density profile.
I guess maybe just to follow up on what you said just now. Are you just matching by requiring the density to be continuous?
Yes, and the enclosed mass to be continuous.
Yeah, I guess at some level I would think that you would want to require some sort of pressure continuity. Like the continuity of the density doesn't seem to enforce static situation.
Yeah, so it's tricky to enforce like a pressure continuity because you don't know necessarily what the pressure is for the NFW in the NFW region.
Why do you need constant enclosed mass as well?
It's
you said taken this what was an NFW profile and dumped it down but kept the mass inside that radius, you're saying.
Yeah, right. You're just
so
restructuring
kind of that the two halos, that's assuming something about like the concentration mass relation or something?
No, you're not. So you're just assuming that the particles inside, you're just kind of assuming that you're just starting with an NFW profile. Incentive self-interactions are just sort of reshuffling the distribution of mass inside of R1.
Just could have affected the formation history of the halo.
Yes.
And then you wouldn't have the same guy in the
center. No, that's absolutely an oversimplification. Really, this should be like an integration over the formation history, which is complicated. And so this is definitely a simplifying approximation.
So you could just keep it as not enforcing that and enforcing that, and then you know, see how it affects your results.
Yes.
So I think maybe more precise way of saying what you said. I think more naturally is to ask for some sort of continuity in phase space, because you know that even the outer region where you obey the NW, that does have to obey some I forget the number of equation. Anyways, there is a relation between the density in real space and density in velocity space.
Yeah.
And I would actually think that you would want to enforce some sort of a continuity in phase space, not just in real space.
Yes.
Otherwise, it just seems too unnatural. Because you could imagine, in the way you're doing it right now, you could imagine there being a strong discontinuity in velocity distribution between those two regions.
Yeah, the problem is we don't know how to match on in that way to the NFW profile. One of the complications is that you're assuming that it's an NFW. We're assuming that's an NFW profile, but the phase-based distribution is actually also modified by the presence of baryons in these halos, and so we actually don't know what that is.
I think there are other profiles where it actually do obey. I forgot the equation.
The first speech is surge or equation?
Huh?
Equation? I mean, like.
So the one other thing we did try was by trying to match the temperature at R1. And it turned out not to work, or gave us very weird looking profiles because of the effect of baryons.
Okay.
Let me go on.
They're all related, of course, but you were the particular genes equation.
Yeah, no, the genes equation. Yeah. Let me go on so I can finish.
Yeah, sorry.
So that's the general prescription, matching at some radius R1, and we want to use this for fitting different halos. Clusters provide a great laboratory for doing this prescription, because there's data spanning a large range of radius through R1, including the self-interacting dark matter regime less than R1 and the NFW regime greater than R1. So here's what we do. The dark matter density is obtained for a large range of radius. And the other thing we have is also the baryon density. So the baryon density is known for these clusters. And so we can include that in phi to incorporate its effects on the dark matter density. So here's what we're doing. We do an MCMC where we're just scanning over our three parameters, the dispersion, the central density, and this unknown parameter R1. And for each parameter point, We have a density profile, and we're just fitting that to the data and just asking how well does it agree with the data. So what data are we using? Well, we're most concerned about the central density. And in the central density, you have stellar kinematics data. So you're looking at basically velocity dispersions of stars inside of that central elliptical galaxy in the cluster. At larger radii, ideally you would fit to all of that gravitational lensing data, but okay, that's a little too complicated for me. What we're doing as a proxy is just basically fitting to essentially the total enclosed mass called M200, which is kind of a proxy for thinking about the large radius distribution of that halo. Okay. And then, okay, we also are enforcing continuity, as I mentioned before. So what do we get? Okay, so here are two example clusters. So this is density as a function of radius. And what I show on this plot is the best fit dark matter profile from this Newman et al. Paper. So this is just a phenomenological fit to this particular cluster using, you know, the cored NFW profile in this case. That's this gray band here. It's kind of hard to see. But then on top of that, I show our fit, our best fit, which is this yellow, this orange line from SIDM. So, okay, it agrees reasonably well with the Newman et al. Band.
Well, it's a log-log plot.
Yeah, okay, sure. But it's not crazy, okay. And then here's another cluster again, all right. Here is the velocity dispersion data. So this is velocity dispersion of the stars in the central galaxy as a function of radius. And the actual data is hard to see, but it's these red boxes here. So the Newman et al. Band from their CNFW fit is this gray band here that kind of goes through the data. And ours is this orange band that looks like this, which also goes through the data. And then you can also fit it with an NFW, which is this cyan line here, which seems not to fit the data very well. OK, and here's two others for a different cluster. So here's the picture of the cluster that I showed you before, A667. This is one with a large core. The other two had small cores. And so I'm going to show you again what that looks like. So this is density as a function of radius. The gray band is the Newman et al. And the orange band is what we get from fitting with SIDM. And so you can see that maybe the fit here is not actually that great. Okay, it kind of agrees at like the 1 sigma error band for these things. But okay, it seems to have a larger core compared to what Newman et al. Find. But if you look at the stellar kinematics data, okay, it agrees well with the data points.
Larger and also flatter.
Yeah, larger and flatter.
Yours is the yellow, right?
Yeah. So maybe this modeling has a systematic bias for favoring sort of larger, flatter profiles compared to what the data would prefer.
How many parameters does NFW have? How many parameters does the code NFW have? And how many parameters does your model have?
NFW is 2 parameters. Right. Cored NFW is 3. And our model is also 3.
Our model is also 3. Okay. What's the, like, I mean, so you've got NFW in your model here. Can you tell, like, what the chi-squared improvement is?
No, not right now. I can't.
Because you've got one more parameter, since you'd always fit it a bit better. But
yes,
you might get a better fit, but you've got the same number of parameters to code on, so you might, like.
Yeah, no, I can't answer that right now.
Well, I mean, NFW goes up. It completely misses the core. What do you mean?
Yeah.
That.
Right, and you've got one more parameter that fits that.
Yeah.
Is it better than just...
The moment you have another data point, it will do better, the password will do better.
Yeah,
I mean, you might be able to see it by eye. I mean, because the NFW goes way above these 3 data points,
yeah.
Whereas this one goes through basically spot on. Okay. So now the idea is to do the same thing for the dwarfs and LSBs. And so we're, okay, using the sample of the dwarfs from things and also a sample of LSBs from this reference here. And the idea is basically the same. We have the dispersion, the central density in R1, which we don't know. And so we're just scanning over this with an MCMC. We're matching to sort of best fit isothermal profiles to these objects here. So we take these as our input and fit to, okay, this same thing, and then the core size that we would get from this. We also require continuity between the SIDM and the NFW regimes at R1. But the problem is, unlike the clusters, we don't have data for large R. So we can't match onto the NFW profile in any way, because we don't know what that profile looks like. So the only thing that we could think of to do is by assuming that the NFW profile that we're matching onto is sort of cosmologically acceptable. So if you look at n-body simulations of CDM, there's a relation between rho s and rs, which, okay, numerically it comes out to be something like this. So I'm just going to assume that the NFW profiles that the self-interacting dark matter is living inside of respect this relation. Okay. So we've done these scans. No, rho s is the NFW rho s.
Right, but if you interpret rho from the equation of the NFW, isn't rho s sort of the density at r equal to rs?
Yeah, up to some constant, yes.
But your isn't that exactly what your model is modifying?
No, so the idea of our very much oversimplified model is that you're starting with some cosmologically acceptable halo. So you're starting with a halo that respects this distribution, and it evolves to something that looks different.
Well, I'm just saying that relation, I'm not criticizing this, but I'm just saying this relation that you're using, that really uses heavily the fact that inside the core you have an NW.
No, it has nothing to do with inside the core. All right. Let me keep going. So, okay, it's of course, I had motivated this based on thinking about cross-section or cross-section per unit mass as a function of velocity. But maybe it's better to think about, you know, velocity average cross-section, cross-section velocity averaged divided by mass as a function of sort of the average velocity in the halo. Because you don't know for an individual scattering what's the velocity, all you know is the average velocity. Okay. So this quantity, okay, just comes from the rate equation, and I want to figure out rho at R1 and set that to be equal to 1, and then I can invert that and figure out this. The relative velocity averaged over the halo, I can also get just from the velocity dispersion, and it's just equal to that. There's just some constant factor. It's about 2. So here's what it looks like, all of the data points. So this is cross-section times velocity averaged over mass as a function of the average velocity. The red are the dwarfs, the blue are the LHBs, and the green are the clusters. And then these lines here are lines of constant cross-section. So what we find is that the dwarfs and LHBs seem to be consistent with a constant cross-section that seems to be around 10 centimeters squared per gram. But the clusters seem to be consistent with a cross-section that's around 0.1 centimeters squared per gram. So now, what does this imply about the particle physics model? So let's just fit it with a very simple model. Just a repulsive interaction. Potential is just some coupling constant, alpha prime, divided by R. And then we have a screening contribution. All right. Yes. Yes, right. That's a great way to say it, yes. So here's the interaction. It's a repulsive interaction from a dark photon. So here's what we get. So I'm just going to fix alpha prime to be 0.01. And we have mediator mass as a function of dark matter mass. And so if you fit individually, it's hard to see these colors. If you fit individually to the dwarfs, LHBs, and the clusters, they each trace out some preferred region in this parameter space. So the dwarfs and the LHBs trace out a very similar region, where it's this wide band here, and then it comes down like this. All right. The clusters, on the other hand, trace out a green region, which is hard to see, but it's up here, and then it comes down like this, or something like that. Okay. The bullet cluster exclusion is this dashed line here, like that, and it excludes everything underneath, like this.
How does it vary when you change alpha prime?
Yeah, that I'm not sure yet. I don't know. Very preliminary.
So it's very interesting, actually. So the caveat is, within the context of one particular model, you can do this fit, and you can figure out, you know, what's the mass of this mediator and what's the mass of this dark matter. And it gives you a closed region. That's pretty cool. How does it pick that out? Oops. Well, for light dark matter, you're in the regime where the cross section is basically constant. Okay? So it doesn't depend on velocity at all. But because the clusters are preferring a smaller cross section than the dwarfs and LSBs, the clusters are preferring a larger value of this mediator mass compared to the smaller halos. So the smaller halos prefer this, and the clusters prefer that, and they don't overlap. So this range of light dark matter is not favored in this model. Now, if you go to very heavy dark matter, like TeV scale dark matter, you get cross sections that are very velocity dependent. It looks like Rutherford scattering. That also is not seen in the data. Okay, it seems to be velocity dependent, but not so velocity dependent where it scales like 1 over v to the fourth. And so that range is also disfavored. And so this range in the middle is like the sweet spot. Seems to be preferred. So here, I'll wrap up. So my conclusions, it's always a good idea not to put all your eggs in one basket. Everyone's been thinking about WIMPs for a long time, but we want to be agnostic about what dark matter could be. So self-interacting dark matter is a good candidate. The models are very simple. There are not very many parameters to think about. And we can test, using astrophysical observations of structure, the properties of dark matter physics, even if it doesn't couple at all to the visible sector, which is really cool. So I also motivated SIDM using these anomalies from CDM and observations of structure, but we don't know if they're real anomalies or maybe they can be explained away. And the interesting thing, which is new, is that clusters have a huge complementary power to constraining the parameter space of self-interacting dark matter. But okay, it's still a work in progress, and we need to understand what are the backgrounds due to baryonic physics, and also the backgrounds, or not backgrounds, but the uncertainties due to additional systematics as well. Thank you.
So in the cosmological scenarios, if you want to, you probably want to somehow this MeV particles to decay for radiation somehow.
It could decay E plus C minus
to dark radiation,
or E plus C minus.
That's probably discoverable, right? Or even it can be excluded, right? I mean, there's a lot of this. If it couples to the standard model, to the fact that it's all thermally excited, this 0.5 MeV, it's probably too low, right?
Yeah, you can have a dark Z, which are decaying neutrinos.
Right.
But then it might decay too late.
But I think the idea is to do what John said, which is don't couple at all.
Still there would be, so somehow excited, right, and then mediated.
Yeah,
naive expectation, there would be non-negligible fraction of them, right, if they're stable.
Well, that depends on the temperature of the dark matter at that point, right? Like, temperature.
Sure,
dark
matter. I mean, well,
you can show pretty
high temperatures, and then you've gone with all of
that. No, you can show pretty generically that even if it's completely decoupled, depending on, independent of what the temperature of the dark sector is, you'll always have these mediator particles which would dominate over the density of dark matter. And the mediator particles are just non-interacting dark matter, effectively.
Right.
And so you're dominated by your non-interacting dark matter instead of your SIDM. Yes, Dottie?
So this range of parameters gets you cores in like all these three sets of objects.
Yeah.
What about missing satellites? Does this range of parameters cut off the mass function? What does this particular cross section do to the power spectrum?
I don't know. I mean, so missing satellites is solved by RAM pressure stripping.
Right, but you could oversolve it, right? I mean, you could get into one of these like catch 22s. This could cut off the mass function such that you never form the dwarfs in the first place.
Yes, so that I don't know.
Right.
That I don't know.
And oh, there might be other cosmological constraints. Right.
Mm-hmm.
The self-interacting dot does cut off the mass function, but I just don't know how it scales.
I don't know either. I mean, you can make a very rough estimate for the interaction rate around like matter radiation equality, and it ends up being very small.
But you are affecting things on like kiloparsec scales, and like you can just translate that into a mass by encoding the density.
Yeah, it's not obvious that for these cross sections it'll have an effect, but it might. Any more questions?
Okay, thanks Sean again.